You're listening to David Luke's Guilty Pleasures on First Choice Radio.
Yes, indeed you are. Welcome back to the Guilty Pleasure Show here on First Choice Radio. Now, I am joined down the line by one of the absolute legends of pop music, especially in the 90s and 2000s, Mr. Elliot Kennedy. Good morning, Elliot.
Morning, indeed. How are you doing?
I'm fine, mate. How are you doing on this Saturday morning?
Great. It's a beautiful day here. Me and Charlie Parker, my husky, have been in the woods behind my head. It's beautiful.
I can just see him in the background of the shot every now and again, just walking behind you on the Zoom call. I love huskies.
This one's a real character.
Yeah. So, I mean, first, before we get into the music and the kind of history of your sort of career, on a human level, on a personal level, how has this last year as a musician and a human been for you, this lockdown time?
You know something, in all kinds of ways, it's a bit of a difficult question because I'm extremely sensitive to how difficult a time it's been for a lot of people. And I don't want to sound flippant at all when I say that it's possibly been one of the most creative times of my life. And I think that's largely down to being here. And I work from home anyway, so I haven't had to go into the studio. And it's just been getting up, going through your morning routine with Charlie in the woods or whatever, and then literally sitting here in front of this screen and my keyboard's right here and seeing where my hands fall and going with it. And that initially started with an album which is now called Mind Music and is available as a sort of cathartic exercise to combat anxiety and stress, because there's a lot of insecurity and people were quite worried about what was going on and what was happening, you know, over just a year ago. So I made an album, you know, just as an exercise, and it's now sort of become its own thing and really helped people sleep and relax and, you know, sort of get through their day. And now I'd sort of do a relaxation show on a Monday night on my own little radio station. And it works. It's worked really well for a lot of people. So that's where it started. Yeah. And then in that crazy year, Gary Barlow insisted that I get on with making an album, which I thought was just insane. And but after a while, I started listening to him and thought, do you know what? Why wouldn't I do it now? I mean, you know, this is the perfect time. It's self-reflection and all the rest of it. So,
yeah.
I ended up with three singles. The new single is out today. Mm-hmm. A Love of Your Own is released today. Did a video out on the Yorkshire coastline, which was lovely. And the album's out and people seem to like it. So who knew, eh?
Yeah. And you mentioned obviously Gary Barlow there, who's one of your closest kind of colleagues and closest friends as well. And we're going to talk a bit more about kind of that connection and that friendship in a little bit. But yeah, and it's quite amazing that you said this has been one of the most creative times of your life. Because, I mean, as a songwriting and producing career goes, when you look at your credits that you've had, it appears that the last sort of 30 years have been the most creative time of your life. Because you've had, you know, you've worked with some of the biggest artists in pop music. We've been Take That, S Club, Bryan Adams, Boyzone, and that's just a few to name. You know, you've had Ivan Novello, Golden Globe nominations, all these amazing accolades. And yet, it's only now that you're kind of stepping out as an artist and becoming an artist for the first time.
It's absolutely nuts. It will actually start at my 50th birthday. Not last year, the year before. And I had this big gig at Sheffield City Hall. We raised 100 grand for the charity. And I had a load of artists from my career come and sing the hit that I've written for them. And that included, you know, Kenny Thomas, S Club, the Take That Boys, Heather Small and Alfie Bo. It was an amazing night. It was a great night. And afterwards, Gary called me and said, "El, look, you need to make an album for this audience, mate. People know who you are. You're not like starting from scratch. You just need to promote it," which was, of course, mental for me because I've never been on that side of the microphone, if you like. So it just seemed insane. But like I was saying, this year happened to us all. And I thought, well, this is probably the time. You know, I can do it all from here. I work from home. So literally, I started writing songs and made the whole album sitting right here. And it, you know,
it's an amazing album as well. I've had it on. What I love about your album, and we'll talk about the album a bit later on in more in depth, but I've sat listening to it in my headphones in my little office here, my little studio here, and what I love about an album is it feels like you're just in the room with a great band playing these great songs. It feels like I'm just sat in the middle of a room with you guys around me playing this music, and I love that.
I I wanted to create like an air of honesty, if I'm honest, David. Yeah. It was the whole point of it was, you know, if I'm going to make a record, it has to be absolute honesty. There's no point in trying to connect with any kind of audience unless I'm just being honest. And what's exactly. the point in trying to be something I'm not at my age? You know, it's just, it's embarrassing. So I just decided I would write a bunch of songs that were stories of my life and little timestamps, if you like, from my life, and see what happens. If people like it, great. If they don't, I've made the album and happy days. And it's interesting. We've actually started a campaign in Europe now as a result. So it seems there's an audience there for it, like there is in different parts of the world. So who knows? One day soon enough, I might be able to actually get on stage and play this stuff.
Let's hope so.
Record, the actual production of the record, I wanted it to feel as intimate as possible. So what you've just said is exactly what I was going for.
Oh, that's great. And shall we get some music on the air, and should we play something from your kind of back catalogue? And we've mentioned Take That, we've mentioned your connection with Gary Barlow. So should we play it was your first number one, I believe, wasn't it?
What's crazy about this is I always had an ambition to have a number one by the time I was 25. I thought if I can achieve that, happy days. We've got a story for the kids and the grandkids. Granddad had a hit one day, you know. And so that was my key ambition. Everything Changes went to number one on my 25th birthday.
Well, let's get it on the air, shall we? Because it's one of my favourite Take That songs. Let's get it on the air. This is Everything Changes, written by Elliot Kennedy, but of course performed by the fantastic Take That. There we go. Take That and Everything Changes. Number one in 1994, I believe, if my memory serves me correct. Yeah. Mr. Elliot Kennedy there, fantastic songwriter. And he's here still on the line with me this morning talking about his life and his career. And so, I mean, obviously, Gary Barlow has been, you know, a kind of a huge part of your life. He's one of your best friends and you've worked with him countless times over the years. I suspect now, all these years later, he knows about the fence issue at his house one day.
Do you know what? I've happened to mention it a couple of too many times, and he pulled me out of hell. After all this time, you didn't tell me. You that broke my... It wasn't me. I happened to be there, but it wasn't me.
I heard that story in another interview that I watched with you, and I knew I had to mention it when I heard it. It was such an amazing story. While we're still talking about Take That, there's something I have to mention, if not for me, for my mum and dad. They've told me I must mention this. I was going to try and fit the song in, but I just didn't have the space to fit this song in. Back in 2003, we went to Florida as a family, to Disney World, as most people do on holiday. And we had two CDs in our car. We had a Peter Kay Live at the Top of the Tower audio version. And then we had like a random compilation CD that we'd put together. And track one on that CD was 4 Minute Warning by Mark Owen.
My God.
And that song was on repeat for our holiday. That became our kind of theme song of our holiday.
Awesome.
So what are your memories of writing that with Mark Owen? Because that was such an amazing song for us as a family. It was one of our favourites.
What's interesting about working with bands like Take That, and the same applies for the Spice Girls or Five or S Club, is that you create sort of... friendships, the dynamic of your friendships with each individual person is very different. You have a friendship and a sort of gang sort of vibe with the whole group, and you hang out and you have a laugh and all the rest of it. But when it comes down to actually talking and spending time with people, you know, you develop different kinds of relationships with different people. Mm-hmm. So Gaz is like my best mate, and we talk every day, and we write most weeks, and we're involved in all kinds of crazy stuff. Yeah. But with Mark, Howard, you know, Robbie, to a lesser degree, we worked together a little bit, but certainly with Mark, I think we just, you know, you find so many sort of things in common and you know, things usually based on your sense of humor and love of music, of course. And Mark is such a great creative. He's an amazing video maker as well. Mm. He makes his own video and he's so good at it. So he's just a great creative. And I remember getting the call from him, do you fancy doing some writing? And I was like, absolutely, I'd love to. So he came up and we started an idea. I was sort of chugging along on my acoustic guitar because it was going to be a little bit more rocky in origin than what we would normally do, say, for Take That. So we just sat there, I with my guitar, and he started with a really cool idea. But the thing with Mark is he's such a perfectionist. He's constantly tweaking and wanting to make it better. And he went off into the other room while I carried on getting a track together. And we'd sort of got an idea of a chorus melody, and that's all we based it on there. But then he went off and he came in and just said, I've had this idea of, you know, 4-minute warning, like it's the end of the world. What would people be doing in that time? And I want each chorus to count down. So we cleverly found the tempo of the song so that when the chorus starts at the beginning, it is literally 4 minutes left of the song. And then every chorus is a minute in. Mm. So the first chorus is 3 minutes left to go, 2 minutes left to go. And then the last chorus to start to fade is 1 minute left to go. And then the fade is 30 seconds. So it's actually 4 minutes long. And it was like a very subtle idea, but it was quite clever, I thought. Mm. And of course, his lyric was fantastic because he just took different stories of people that he created. But what I found amazing, he's so good at this, I could immediately visualize what these people look like, you know, in 4 minutes. So it turned out to be one of my favorites. And then, you know, even better than that, Gary and I got to produce it, which was lovely. Yeah. So it sort of wrapped up, you know, like we did with Howard was always, you know, we were always very close with Howard and still are. And of course, Gary, Howard and Mark have this now lifelong bond. Yeah, exactly. So it was lovely to have them around to the studio at the time to work together. And it sort of closed the circle, if you like. But it still is one of my favourite songs. We did it at that birthday party I was talking about. Mark was amazing.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. And I will say thank you on behalf of my mum and dad for indulging them in that as well. Now, the next song I've got lined up is a song that I actually didn't know was one of yours until I played it. It was the first track I played when I started this radio show about a month ago. And when I was kind of researching, you know, chart positions and stuff like that for the song to give information on the air, that's when I discovered it was one of your songs and I generally didn't know. And that is S Club and Bring It All Back.
Oh, well, there you go.
So go on. I mean, S Club were one of the biggest pop acts of that period, the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
But this was their debut song. So when you were making this song, they weren't known. So that must have been
So I had them for about six. This is a project that was managed by the same person, Simon Fuller, who managed the Spice Girls. And we actually introduced the Spice Girls to Simon. So we'd got a very close friendship. And he said, look, I'm working on this project. You know, I'd like you to get involved. So I just said, look, can I have them for a few weeks? And they came up and stayed in Sheffield. And I remember taking them all out for lunch. So excited. I mean, that energy of a brand new young band is brilliant. You know, you want to try and bottle that energy if you can, because it's so enthusiastic, so positive. So I took them out for lunch and we were sat there and I said to them all, so what do you want to do? And they sort of all looked at me really surprised and said, what do you mean? I said, well, look, this is your album. You know, what do you want to do? This is not my album. You're going to have to sing these songs hundreds and hundreds of times. So let's make it yours. Let's make it, you know, belong to you. And they were like, wow, okay. Well, we were thinking, and immediately then that was it. They were off to the races. Well, we really like the Jacksons. You know, we want to do something with that kind of energy. So literally went from lunch to the studio and wrote Bring It All Back, which has a sort of Jacksons-y sort of feel to it.
Definitely.
ABC and, you know, all that kind of era of Jacksons. At pop, so that's how it started, and they did such a brilliant job, and I'm so proud of them all. They worked really hard.
It's an amazing song. But let's get it on the air right now. This is S Club 7's debut hit from 1998. This is brilliant. So there we go, S Club 7, Bring It All Back, 1998, one of the biggest and best pop tunes of that period, in my opinion. Now, it's funny, with S Club 7, obviously they were a mixed boy-girl act from that period. Now, anyone that knows me will know that I am a huge fan of another band of that kind from that era, which is Steps. And
yeah.
I think people won't probably realise, with all the songs and hits you've had, is that you were actually involved in the comeback of Steps in 2011.
Yes, I was. It was the TV show about putting them in the studio and doing a cover, and we did Dancing Queen. When I was asked which cover, I said there's got to be one. There's only one song we could do that would represent that era of, because they were sort of, you know, they had that sort of ABBA flavour to them in all kinds of ways.
Well, they were called by Pete Waterman ABBA on Speed. That's what they were kind of known as.
So there's, you know, it had to be Dancing Queen, and the guys were really up for it. And we just had the best time. It was like a fun experience, putting them all in the studio together, getting them to sing again and sing, work together and get back into the team, you know, teamwork. It was just lovely. We had a really fun day. Now, thankfully, I already knew Lisa.
Yeah.
And we were, but I hadn't met the other guys, but they were just beautiful. Faye is possibly one of the nicest people I've ever met in my life. Mm. So it's lovely.
What was the atmosphere like? Cause, I mean, the way the TV show put it across, and kind of we knew this was going to happen with a show like that. They tried to kind of show friction between the five of them at moments. I'm well aware with how TV works, it will have been heightened to a degree. But what was it like being in the room with them?
The word they love is jeopardy.
Yeah,
that's what they ask for. Mm. Where's the jeopardy? You know, I hear that all the time in television, and sometimes there just isn't any. So, you know, I remember they wanted to try and create drama. But listen, these guys, they've spent so much time together. I'm sure they've got their peccadilloes in terms of the dynamic of their friendship. Any band. But it wasn't acrimonious at all. They have their roles that they play. If anything, I tried to break the pattern a little bit and get them all to sing parts of it where it might be all Claire. That might have been a bit weird for Claire, but she dealt with it. She's professional, for God's sake. They're all so they just got on with it because at the end of the day, they were in the studio working. I mean, we take these things for granted and certainly have this year. Mm. So, you know, they're professional people and they've gone on to do tours since and, you know, making new records and stuff. So it was not acrimonious at all. It was just a great fun day.
Yeah. Well, moving on from Steps then, we have another, alongside Gary Barlow, another of your closest friends and closest kind of colleagues in this industry, which is Bryan Adams.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Bryan Adams obviously has been a hit maker for, you know, for nearly 40 years at this stage. So how did your association with him come about?
So serendipitously. I went to see him at Sheffield Arena because I was a Bryan Adams fan. I still am, for that matter. Mm. And I went to see him on that. And then the next day, I used to, you know, if I was writing lyrics, I used to try and get out of the studio because it's a bit distracting, you know, phone ringing, people popping in, whatever. So I would go out and either go for a walk or go and do the studio shopping or whatever, you know, the coffee and the milk and all that business, just to get out of the space. And I was out with my dictaphone in, I think it was Safeways at the time in Sheffield, and I was pushing my trolley around and my phone rang, which back in those days was one of those big old brick. So when it vibrated, you really knew about it because it moved up. Even the trolley vibrated, I think. So I was walking through and my phone rang and I answered hello and he went, hey, is this Elliot? And I said, yeah. And he went, hey man, this is Bryan Adams. And I just laughed and swore at him. Which he laughed at and he went, no, man, it's really Bryan Adams. I love your Spice Girls record. And I went, okay, now I know you're taking that and swore at him. And until I realized, I said, why are you calling me? And he went, well, man, you know, I'm in the north. I know you're up here. I'm in Manchester. I went, I know. I saw you in Sheffield last night. He said, well, man, you know, you want to come over and have a cup of tea? I literally got my trolley and pushed it. And left it there in the middle of the aisle and got in my car and drove over to Manchester. And sure enough, he made me a cup of tea, which, by the way, for a Canadian was a pretty good cup of tea. Sat and talked and became friends. And we still are. We like a lifelong friendship. And we started writing together almost immediately. And that friendship has taken us all over the world writing. We have so much fun. I mean, he's one of my closest friends and we laugh hell of a lot.
Doesn't that just sum up the music industry, that kind of, you know, opportunity can come about whilst you're doing your shopping in the supermarket? And it's just amazing. I mean, this song that I've picked of his is a song that I've loved for a lot of years. It's a song that I've sung myself countless times with various people. So it's When You're Gone, which was obviously with Bryan Adams and Mel C singing on it as well. So what are your memories of writing and recording this one?
So it was very late in the making of the album On A Day Like Today. And we'd written a couple of songs that we were really happy with. But he said to me, Al, you know, look, I'm going out to Vancouver to record. If you've got any ideas, you know, we could do with something maybe up tempo. If you've got any ideas, give me a shout. And I put the phone down and literally, it was a Sunday afternoon, literally started writing the chorus to When You're Gone. picked up my guitar. And it's always the same with Brian. Once ever he does things like this, and listen, what he normally does is this. I remember him, he said the first time I worked with, on something that turned out to be a single, which was the song Back to You from his Unplugged album.
Yeah.
I was in LA, he was in Vancouver, and he invited me up to Vancouver to go and work with him. But he said to me, the very parting shot at the end of the phone call was, "Hey, Al, man, if you don't have a hit, don't get on a plane." Okay, so he knows what he's doing. So when he does that, he lights that flame in me that goes, right, okay, I'm going to show you, you know, and I wrote the chorus to Back to You, When You're Gone. And I called him, you know, half an hour later or whatever, and went and sang it down the phone. He went, "Al, get in your car right now, man, come down." So I went down to London and saw him. And, you know, we end up, over the next couple of days, he went to Vancouver. That couple of days, we wrote the song. And I remember about a couple of weeks later, he called me and went, "Hey, Al, this song has really worked out well. It sounds great with the band. It's rocking. It feels like a single. I'm thinking about getting Sheryl Crow to sing on it." And I said, "Wow." He says, "Do you know, like a harmony, not a duet as such, but like a harmony all the way through it." I said, "That sounds cool." So he reached out to Sheryl. Obviously, we've got a timeline problem because he needs to mix the album, deliver it. Sheryl was on tour and couldn't do it. So he said to me, "Is there anyone in the UK that you think you could do this? Is it maybe a Spice Girl?" And I said, "Well, if it was going to be a Spice Girl, it would be Mel C."
Yeah.
Because she's got a voice that could handle your voice. And I said, "I'm actually going to see the girls. They're in Sheffield Stadium." Sadly, they're not there anymore, but they're in Sheffield Stadium this weekend. I'm going to go and see them. So I went back to see the girls before the show and said to Mel, "Brian Adams wants you to do a song with her." And he's like, "Oh, look," she goes, "I love Brian Adams. It'd be great. I'd love to do it." You know, not so long after, we were making a record with Mel C, and it turned out to be When You're Gone, and what a brilliant job they did.
Well, let's play it now on First Choice Radio. This is Brian Adams, Mel C. This is When You're Gone. There we go. When You're Gone, Brian Adams, Mel C on First Choice Radio. I'm still joined by the fantastic Elliot Kennedy. He's still here on the line with me. And so the next song we're going to talk about in a minute is the Boyzone track, Picture of You, which, again, a song, you know, a soundtrack to many people's lives. It was for the Mr. Bean movie, which I think a lot of people maybe don't remember as well. But this was the song that earned you an Ivor Novello Award.
Yeah.
So, I mean, as a songwriter, that's just the Holy Grail, surely.
Listen, my favourite songwriters in the world are Ivor Novello Award winners. So, you know, to be on that list is, it's beyond an honor. It was the absolute highlight of my career. And you know, it's difficult to put into words what it means to you when you're there receiving an award. I got mine from Errol Brown of Hot Chocolate.
Wow.
Which is again very cool. But it's the song itself was probably one of the most difficult songs to write in all kinds of ways. Because it was for the movie Bean, the ultimate disaster movie. it was the film company had a very, very strict remit that they wanted the song to be representative of the story of the film, which, you know, in essence is about a famous painting called Whistler's Mother that has been bought back by an American gallery. It's an American painting, Whistler was, and they wanted it back in America, and of course the Royal Gallery or whatever it was, the picture gallery, was a bit miffed that it was going back to America. So instead of sending a scholar with it to talk about the painting, they sent Mr. Bean. It was just a security guy. And of course, you know, it's a nightmare. And but then we were also told by the record label, "Yeah, that's all well and good, but this song's going to be sung by Boyzone. And we want it to be a love song." But the film company then said, "Yeah, but there's no love story. We don't want a love interest in the song." But the same song had to suit both purposes. So it was about finding, and like anything in life, it's about a relationship. And what we had to sort of work out was the dynamic of what that relationship meant between the two main characters, Mr. Bean and the curator of the gallery in America, where he just ruins his life. But it sort of, you know, I remember writing the lyric and then kind of going, oh, this really, oh, but it doesn't work for the film. And writing it again and going, yeah, this works for the film, but it's not a love song. So, you know, it was a difficult thing to write. Eventually, identifying the common theme here was expectation. And the gallery guy had this expectation, this guy was going to come along and was going to be a genius and was going to change his life. Even though all of the people who knew said, this is a mistake. That sounds like a relationship. You know, when you've fallen for a girl that might be the wrong girl for you and all your mates are going, this is wrong for you. The heart wants what the heart wants. Exactly. So it became, and the idea being, I had a picture of you, you know, like the idea of, I had an image that you were going to be this and you turned out to be the opposite.
Yeah.
But who would have known that it would have worked out at the end of the day, you know, even though you turned my life upside down. So that's how it started. And thankfully, ticked all the boxes and became another hit record. It was a big hit record. And of course, ended up winning an Ivor for best song in a film. Unbelievable experience.
I mean, a great song. I mean, so the Ivor novella is one thing, but the thing I was amazed about, the story that I heard about you, was the Golden Globe story. Which we funny we should talk. We had the Bryan Adams track on it. It was a song you wrote with Bryan Adams for the Bobby film.
Clint, yeah.
And the story that I heard about you on the red carpet at the Golden Globes, when I heard the story, made me laugh. Do you mind telling that story?
No, I don't mind at all. The funny thing about those occasions, and listen, I'm still this guy from Sheffield, right? So you know, you've got to start every story of awards and all this business by casting me, a big northern lad from Sheffield, as the guy, without thinking Hollywood and all the rest of it. So Brian had collected me from the hotel, and we'd both got these tuxedo. I look like an emperor penguin. And like a bit that had fallen off me. And we get in this limo and we go along, and eventually we get to the red carpet. You see the limos dropping their people off. And it's funny because it made me laugh, but Brian thought I was a bit upset about it. It made me laugh. Brian got out of his car, the car, and the cameras starts here. I get out of the car and you can sort of hear this collective, who the bleeding hell's that? From the camera. And they're just polishing their lenses at this point, you know, which made me laugh because it's like they're expecting some superstar to get out. Anyway, the first person we came up to, and there's a bank of cameras all on one side, and then there's an audience of prize winners, you know, on the other, looking at people on the red carpet. There's all these actors having photos and all this kind of thing. So the first person we came to was Quest from CNN, the big gregarious English guy, you know. Yeah. I saw him and I was like, hey, man, I know you are. I watch CNN all the time. So I go up to him and he says, okay, here we are live at the Golden Globe Awards. And here's Brian Adams. Brian, you've been here many times and you've been with Oscars and all the rest of it. But Elliot Kennedy, this is your first time at the award. What does the Golden Globes mean to you? Now, the problem is, and Brian says this to me, he said, El, the further away we get from Yorkshire, the more Yorkshire you get. You actually start talking with your shoulders, which made me laugh. So my response to what does the Golden Globes mean to you, to Quest, was, Golden Globes, that's what brass monkeys lose in the winter where I'm from.
Fantastic. Equally an amazing experience.
What are you going to get? Yeah. Just turned out total scream.
But it must have been an amazing experience to be there. And although it wasn't a win, but you were nominated, it was something to be there surrounded by all those people and the glamour and the glitz of it all. For a lad from Sheffield, it must have been a real sort of...
And you know, the highlight of it for me was just on the next table to me was the cast of Lost, which I was absolutely addicted to. So I just had to go and hug Hurley, the big guy. And I went up to him and hugged him, and he was like, okay, dude. I was like, you don't understand. You're in the bed. Night, you know, it's just and so I ended up chatting to those guys and totally enjoyed the whole experience. It was surreal, you know, watching Tom Hanks walk past you and, you know, on the way to the men's room. It's just bizarre, yeah. But fun. And we had so much fun times there.
Well, let's get your Ivor Novello winning song on, which is Boyzone from the Bean movie. This is Boyzone and Picture of You. There we go, Boyzone and Picture of You. again, I think about 98, I think again, from the Bean movie. Fantastic song, big here in the UK, and of course written by the fantastic Elliot Kennedy, who is still with me on the phone, live on air with us this morning. Now, this next section, I know my other half will be listening intently downstairs, because this next section we're going to be leading up to playing the Spice Girls record, Say You'll Be There, which I dare say is probably your biggest, like, international hit.
Probably the biggest.
I guess so. And Lindsay will be the first to say she is one of the world's biggest Spice Girls fans, and when she knew that I was talking to you, she was quite jealous. So,
Who was she?
Say again, sorry?
Was she in the Spice Girls? All the had their favourite. Who was Lindsay?
Well, you know, there's a she should be cringing at me telling this now, but there's a great picture of her from, I believe it's one of her mum's birthday parties years and years ago, where she is dressed as a sort of hybrid of posh and Scary Spice, I think.
Really?
I think Scary Spice. Oh no, but Posh and Sporty Spice. I apologise.
Okay.
She's dressed like a hybrid of the two, so she's probably somewhere in that area, I think. And funny enough, when I first met my other half and I used to go to watch her play at gigs, this is actually a song that she would play quite a lot.
Big
song. So, I mean, again, similar to S Club, you were sort of working with the Spice Girls again before the bomb went off, if you like, before the kind of the pandemonium started. So, what was that experience like?
Where there was pandemonium. Don't it started anyway.
So what was that initial meeting with them like, and the kind of process of creating those first few songs with them?
Was it a little bit more convoluted than that? The guy who had originally put them together, Chris Herbert, wanted to see me about working with a different project. And I went to have a meeting with him in London at my manager's office, and he was a lovely guy, very, very polite and very respectful guy. And he was working with his dad, God rest his soul, Bob. And they were building a management company. And I wasn't that blown away with the artist they were talking about. So I said, do you work with anyone else? You know, have you got any other projects going? And he said, yeah, we've got this thing going, but it's not quite ready yet. You know, it's a bit early, too early to work with someone like yourself. And I was like, really? Why? He said, well, you know, we don't quite know what it is yet. It's going to be sort of pop R&B. It's five girls. And I was like, wow, that sounds fun. Mm. I said, I'll tell you what, let me work with them first, and then we can maybe talk about the other artists. So we you know, decided on a date, and we said, great, okay, we'll work it out. So that date was coming up soon. It was like booked for a Monday. So I booked a studio in Sheffield, which actually I now own. I ended up buying that studio. But it was quite a big control room, and still is. And I thought it would be a nice space for having five girls down. So I booked the studio. And the night before, I remember calling my manager saying, do we know if these girls are coming tomorrow? And he went, well, if they don't turn up, they'll have to pay the cancellation fee or whatever. Mm. Late that night, I got a phone call from the studio. Elliot, there's two girls here from a girl group you're working with tomorrow. They need to see you. And I was in another studio. So they came up and saw me, and it was Mel B and Jerry. And they said, look, we've got this situation. We're firing our manager tomorrow morning.
Wow.
And they wouldn't give us your number. So we've just driven to Sheffield to find you. And I was like, wow, okay. And I said, how did you find me? So, well, we've just called every studio until someone had your number.
Wow.
It's 5 hours. I thought, well, that's dedication.
Yeah.
So I said, well, yeah, of course you're here. We're doing it. I don't even know your manager, you know. It's not a problem. You've come up. Let's get on with it. So the next morning, we met Mel C and Vicky and Emma came up on a bus from London, tells you everything. And we picked them up at the bus station. I went back to the studio, and it was like, right, is there anywhere we can stay? And that was it then. So overnight, I adopted five sisters. I got run to the settee because they took the three bedrooms that I'd got. And my studio was in my house. So they crashed over. I could never get in the bathroom, you know, never could keep the toilet roll in the house. God knows what they do with that. And then that was it, the beginning of a fantastic friendship. And we just had absolutely amazing fun writing songs and making records, and Say You'll Be There was one of those songs that I wrote in my little semi-detached house in North Anston outside Sheffield.
Yeah, so from where it all started with that song, with, you know, you having these five, you know, at that point unknown girls around your house writing music.
I was giving them petrol money to get up to the studio and taking them for pizzas and stuff.
So when you saw then in the years that followed, what happened to that? I mean, Say You'll Be There was one of the first releases. I think it was it the first, a second single, I think it might have been. And so to see what happened to that song and to their career, it must have been almost like a big brotherly sort of proud moment watching this kind of meteoric rise. And now the Spice Girls, along with very few acts, are part of pop culture. Like, it's
very big brotherly about them. So yes, I was super proud. They're working hard and they took every opportunity. And that, do you know what? They're such beautiful people and continue to be. And so I'm just so proud to have been a part of that process.
Yeah.
And got to sort of be a, you know, ride on that wave. And we just had so much fun. There's nothing but fond memories of that time. So it's, you know, every time I hear that song, I'm back in my house with these five crazy chicks throwing ideas at me left, right, and centre.
Do you think then, on a personal level, do you think we'll ever see them as a five again? Do you reckon we'll ever see the five girls together?
I don't know. And I don't... It's a tough one. They've tried it a few times, and it kind of doesn't feel like it's really worked, because it feels a bit sort of, I don't know, manipulated or forced in some way. So I don't know. People love nostalgia. And you know, those gigs sell really well, and I think that people want to go and see them because they want to relive that part. That, listen, we all love celebrating the soundtrack of our lives.
Yeah.
So, you know, to be able to go back to those times, and you've grown up, you've got kids of your own to introduce and share that. I have that as a parent. You know, I'm always trying to share those memories with my kids and let them know how it was, you know. So it's one of those things, but I don't know, you know, it comes down to, you know, is there a real positive and honest reason for doing it? Mm-hmm. I'd love to see them all together as a band again, doing what they do, as long as they wanted to do it and they wanted to have fun, because unless you're doing it for the right reasons, there's no point in doing it.
Exactly. Well, let's get the song on. This is the fantastic Spice Girls and Say You'll Be There. Huge, huge hit. Let's hear it on First Choice Radio. Here we go. So there we go, Spice Girls, Say You'll Be There on First Choice Radio. Still sounds great today as it ever did back then as well. Fantastic record. Now we are coming up to the top of the hour, which means I need to get the news in very, very soon. And Elliot has agreed to stick around for a few more minutes. And after the news, we're going to be chatting about his fantastic new album, which is called A Yacht Named Sue, created during this kind of bizarre period we've all been in. And we'll be chatting about that and playing one of the tracks from the album too. We'll be back here in just a couple of minutes.
The answer to that is no.
You're listening to David Luke's Guilty Pleasures on First Choice Radio.
Yes, you are. This is the Guilty Pleasure Show here on First Choice Radio on this Saturday. Well, now afternoon. We're into the afternoon of the show now. And I'm still joined on the line by the fantastic Mr. Elliot Kennedy. Thank you for sticking with us, Elliot.
Very welcome, mate. It's lovely to be with you.
And so I wanted to make sure we had a nice chunk of time now to talk about what's going on in your life currently, which of course is this amazing new album, which is called A Yacht Named Sue. And you touched on it earlier, it was kind of, you know, born out of lockdown, but also it was Gary Barlow that sort of pushed you into it.
Yeah, he did. He totally did. He came and afterwards called me and said, you need to make an album. And I just thought he was insane. So I ignored him completely. And then a couple of weeks later, went to see the boys on tour. And he'd actually arranged for me to meet an agent. And I said to him, what is it with you, honestly? And he went, Al, I'm not letting it go. You need to make an album. So I just thought, I didn't think about it. He went, Al, you're a singer. You need to make a record. So do you know what? I've always loved singing. And I've always sung backing vocals on my records and things like that. And I've loved being a music. I love what I get to do. And still be able to go to the chip shop and all that business and be a normal person. So it's been a funny old thing stepping out in front of the microphone. Now, don't get me wrong. I love performing. I love doing gigs and I love singing on stage. But it's interesting. Before I'd go on stage, someone would say to me, "Hell, you don't look nervous at all." I go, well, I'm not, because it's not what I do. I get away with murder out there, you know. My day job is behind the microphone, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a funny thing, sort of mentally, sort of approach it. But I just thought, you know what? There's no change here. I'm just going to be myself. There's no point in someone my age. I'm 51 years old. Why would I try to make out I'm something I'm not at this point? I'm a songwriter, and I can sing. And yes, I've got an artistic side in that I like to express honesty and I like to transfer emotion. That's what artists do. Whether you're a painter or an architect or a choreographer or whatever, your intention is to transfer emotion. So I've just tried to be as honest as I can. And let's be honest, mate, I can't be anything else, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, I try to maintain that that is who I am. And, you know, if you don't pretend, you don't have to work hard at trying to be something else. So it is an honest statement. There are moments from my life on the album that are sometimes painful. But that's what makes us humans. And that's what I hope connects with people.
I said to you off air during one of the breaks that, you know, I've listened to the album a few times during the week. I've listened to it in the car when I've been kind of running around, you know, doing essential business, of course. And then the other day when I was writing the interview, I put it in through my headphones, these, you know, headphones I'm wearing in the office now. And the thing that struck me, and it's a thing that I've always tried to do when I've made music in the past, is it just sounded like I was sat in the middle of a great band playing these songs. Like, it doesn't sound false, it doesn't sound overly manufactured or overly sort of synthetic. It sounds like a real great band in a room, yeah. And you're just placed right in the middle of it listening to these great songs. Was that quite a conscious thing when you were kind of the style of production you wanted to kind of achieve with it?
I wanted the whole album to feel real, and I keep coming back to this word honest, because, you know, I think that nowadays more than ever, it's what we look for in each other. This incredibly self-reflective time we've all had, where we've probably, for all kinds of good reasons, had to reevaluate what our values really are. You know, what's actually the most important to us all. And I think that that comes down to integrity, honesty, love, more importantly. Mm. And those that we love that we haven't been able to see, our friends that we haven't been able to get together and hug and kiss, and all of these things lead to one simple word, and that's love. So I just thought, well, if I'm going to do this, I need to make an album that is an honest representation of who I am and what I stand for, what my values are. And that comes down to the way that I make the music and record it. One of the favorite things I've discovered in the last couple of years is a band called Young Gun Silver Fox, who are sort of yacht rock nowadays. You know, they're absolutely brilliant, super talented, and all of their records are made like they used to make them in the 70s and 80s. So I thought, I want to do something like that. That's what I love. It's what I grew up on. So I decided if I'm going to make an album, it's going to be what I love, because I think artists need to make an album for themselves first. And then hopefully people will listen to it and get it and understand it. And if it's done with integrity and honesty, it will connect on that level. That's been the point of doing it all along.
Yeah. You said it earlier when we were talking about S Club, you said, you know, at the end of the day, they had to know that they were going to have to sing these songs hundreds of times, and they've got to love what's there because it's going to be part of their lives for, you know, however many years afterwards.
When you've been to a gig, and I used to say this to young artists all the time, so what was it? What was the gig that made you realize you wanted to do this? Oh, it was probably Beyonce, or it was whatever, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
For me, it was Mood, you know. And I remember, and I say to them, so what was the song? Oh, I don't know. Well, what was the lyric? There must have been a lyric that got to you, and I don't know. I said, that's because all that happened here is you went home feeling differently than when you arrived.
Yeah.
Which means what they did was transfer the emotion. That's what you're looking for. That's what you want. I think fundamentally, first and foremost, we want to be inspired as people.
Yeah.
Before we start doing whatever it is we're going to do, we want to be inspired. And that's what happens when you're honest. That's what happens when you're being truthful about what you're singing or whatever. That's how it comes about. So it's got to be about that experience.
Yeah. So obviously the album's out now. The album came out last weekend and has done very, very well and is doing very, very well. You've got a new single which has been released today,
and today,
which the video went out for a couple of days ago. The song's called A Love of Your Own. And it's got we spoke about this off air. You put a bonus track on the single release.
Yeah.
Which I listened to last night when it came out, and my first reaction was, wow, if I'd just made an album and I had this sitting in the catalogue of those stuff written for the album, why the hell did I not put that on the album? So what was your thinking behind that?
It's a special song to me, Turn Out the Stars, and in all kinds of ways, I mean, listen, the album's full of special songs to me. Songs like, Don't Raise Me Up is very personal to me. And When Love Breaks Down is about my divorce. You know, Sweet Starts the Day is about my love, Becky. So it's you know, Turn Out the Stars was actually a story about someone who I was totally crazy about that just wasn't interested in me at all. So it's, you know, it's one of those situations we've probably all been through at some point. And again, it's embarrassing, but the best thing to do is to express it and purge it, because there's a good chance other people have experienced these things.
Exactly.
So it comes from an honest place, but it's so special to me that I didn't want to tuck it away on the album somewhere. I wanted it. And also, here's the thing. The album was coming out before this single, which was going to be on the album, A Love of Your Own. I'd done a video for Love of Your Own, but I wanted, you know, there to be a reason to go to have a listen to it or to download it or whatever. And I wanted to put a great song on there that wasn't the B-side. It felt like a proper statement. So I made the decision to not put it on the album. There's a good chance it won't get listened to as much, but I hope people discover it just because they want to hear more music of mine. So that's why I did it that way.
So we've talked about your career now. We've heard all these hits that you've had over the years, and we've got this fantastic new album now, which is kind of the current thing you're promoting and you're kind of selling at the moment. But I want to take you back now to kind of your childhood and the kind of, I think this, from when I heard the story, it really resonated with me because I had a very, very similar experience, and that was how music sort of affected your school life and how that ended up being the thing that kicked off your career really and gave you the kick you needed to go and do it. So from my experience at school is that I would do whatever I could to avoid lessons because I knew that I wanted to be sat behind a piano in the music department and writing songs, and I wrote dozens of songs in my time at school when I should have probably been in geography or history or something else. And so when I heard your story, it's very, very similar and really resonant. Do you mind talking to us about that?
That's all. I mean, anyone from my school that I went to school with me remembers me as the guy at the piano in the main hall every break, every lunchtime, after school. I'd borrow synthesizers. My mum and dad had nothing. We had no money. So, you know, I didn't have opportunities like that. So I would borrow synthesizers and stay behind school and play with them and make noises. And I just couldn't get enough of music. I was just, you know, I've had a lifelong love affair with music, and thankfully it continues. It never lets me down. It's always there at the week, you know, when I've been at my weakest. And it started then, you know, it probably started earlier than that in actual fact. But that time of being in school, and we actually did a gig to raise money for school funds. And it was a great gig. And we did actually, we were allowed to buy equipment that we wanted. So the music department bought a Porter studio and a synth and a drum machine, I think. And that was it. It was the worst thing they could have done, because that's all I wanted to do. And I would go in at half eight and go, I'll just have a listen to what I did yesterday. And I'd look at my watch and it was half four, you know. And you just, days and weeks lost doing things. I made a whole album in my upper sixth year. And at the end of that year, I was mixing it. Everyone else was losing since the last day of school. I was mixing my album backstage on the theater, you know, the main hall stage, with my headphones on, trying to bounce it onto a cassette, you know, so I could listen to it at home. And I turned around and there was the headmaster, Mr. Forster, big guy. I'm 6'6", so he was as good and tall as me.
Yeah.
And he very commanding guy. And he looked at me and he went, can I have a listen? I gave him the headphones and he went, this is good. You know, what are you doing next year? And I said, well, I'm going to come back and carry on with sixth form. And he just said to me, why? What are you doing that for? You know, look around you, Elliot. These kids don't know what they want. You know exactly what you want. So what are you waiting for? And it has been the most significant bit of advice, so much so that I did a charity gig at my old school to raise some funds for the school, which was lovely. And I invited some artists into my old school hall. And on the same stage that I did Calamity Jane and, you know, and all. I did a gig and I found Mr. Forster and got him up on stage and gave him a Spice Girls platinum disc and said to him, you know, if you hadn't given me the advice on this very stage to get on with my life, this and many other songs would have never been written, you know. Yeah. So I owed it. It was a lovely way of closing the circle.
Yeah, I mean,
and bringing it to the same stage.
It's an amazing thing. That's where our stories differ, because I know that my headmaster at my school would have never have been that kind and would never have been that amazing to say, well, clearly you know what you're doing, to go off and do it. I think every kid who's grown up loving music has got a similar story like that, has got a thing of they were always found with a guitar in the hand or behind a piano or wherever it might be for, you know, days and weeks on end.
It's like an incurable virus, music, but a beautiful one.
Yeah.
And it's not about, you know, doing something else. You can't not do it. You can't not do music. It's like in you, you've got to somehow make it work. And listen, we do other jobs. I worked in a Wimpy and did Mr. Wimpy Christmas, you know, birthday parties. And, you know, if you ever need a hokey cokey, I'm the guy. And anything I could that allowed me to be in a studio as long as I possibly could be, and then have to go and earn a bit more money so I could go and do it again. And that was all I wanted to do, until eventually the studio couldn't get rid of me, so they had to take me on as a T-boy. You know, and you know, you take the dip in money because it doesn't matter. You beat around music. And I started there as a T-boy in a studio, which meant that when the session was over, I could stay and do my demos and learn the gear. And that's where it started for me. And it should start for everyone. It's one of those things where you can't not do it. Listen, I came from nothing. I had no opportunities. There's no one giving me a leg up other than the studio guy letting me go and bug him, you know, as often as I could.
Yeah.
And eventually I started working for him. And that led me to being a songwriter and record producer. And I just couldn't not do it. It's as simple as that.
Can you remember the first song you ever wrote? Can you remember the first thing you ever wrote?
Called Love Machine. it was sort of electronic and absolutely terrible. A drum machine, a bass line, and a lead synth echoing the melody of the song.
Yeah.
And I convinced two girls on my road to come and be in my band, which never got out of my bedroom, you know. And my dad was a singer on the club, so we had a Carlsberg PA. And two mics, and they would come up and sit there watching me play my Wasp synthesizer and electric organ and drum machine. And I just thought I was a superstar. Every time they would come round to like sing my crappy songs, I'd dress up, you know, because I just thought, well, they don't want to be in a band with me. You know, I think I was 12 at the time, but, you know, I just wanted to be in the Human League.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, the album's out now, which is fantastic, and we're going to play the single from that in just a moment. The big question now is, what's next? What's kind of coming up on the horizon that you've got, that you're looking forward to, that you're excited about?
A few years ago, Gary Barlow and I wrote a Broadway musical called Finding Neverland,
I never got time to ask you about that, because I'm a huge fan of that musical. I particularly love Something About This Night, which I think is a fantastic song.
Yeah, it was a fantastic experience. I mean, I got the bug for it, you know, writing Broadway musicals. So Gary and I wrote another one, which we're going to hopefully produce next year or so. And then I've been writing a new musical. Do you know the iconic photograph of the men sitting on a...
Yeah, of course, yeah.
High above New York. I've basically written a musical about that photograph. It's called Empire State Dreams, and it's about the immigrants that built New York. So it's a sort of celebration of diversity. It feels like the perfect time for it, you know, right now, especially in that country. So it's fun. It's dramatic. There's a great love story. So I've spent so much of my time. I'm actually presenting it next week.
Wow.
To producers. So I've sort of gotten to this point where I feel confident. I'm about 9 or 10 songs in. I feel really confident about it. So it's time to start playing it to people. So that's been a massive thing. I'm now working with an amazingly talented guy called Tom Seals, who's a brilliant pianist and singer, sort of, you know, a bit of a sort of Billy Joel sort of vibe.
I'm Facebook friend with Tom Seals. I know the guy and know his kind of history.
I've literally just started writing for him. So next week, I'm going to write two more songs for him. So yeah, it's busy times. And Gary Barlow and I, of course, have all got, we're always cooking up something stupid. You know, we've always got fun things to do. Brian Adams and I are talking about making a new record. So it's going to be a busy time. Listen, I wake up every day, list all the things that I'm thankful for, because somehow I'm still allowed to do this, and that I never, ever take for granted.
Well, I think that's an amazing place to wind things up. Such an amazing career, an amazing life, and the amazing thing is, you're probably nowhere near halfway done yet. There's so much more to come. I know there will be. Because in comparable terms, when you look at these amazing songwriters of the years, you look at someone like Paul McCartney, who's been around 60-plus years. We're not even scratched the surface yet with you, and I'm well aware of that. I'm going to play your new single now, which is called A Love of Your Own. Would you introduce it for us?
Yeah, this is one of my favourite songs from my life. It's by the Average White Band. And I chose to put other people's songs on my album because I don't care who's written the song. It's about what it represents. And this, for me, represents that pursuit of happiness that we're all after. We're looking for the one. I think I found her, thankfully. And, you know, this is a celebration of that emotion. So it's one of my favorite songs, and I hope people like my version of it. So it's here's A Love of Your Own.
Elliot, thank you very much, mate. We'll see you again soon, I'm sure.
Appreciate it.
What about that, eh? Elliot Kennedy, absolutely amazing guy. Thank you very much for coming on. Just what an hour and 20 minutes we spent with that guy, talking about his career. He's a fantastic life in music, and the fact that he is only just getting started, really, as well.
You're listening to David Luke's Guilty Pleasures on First Choice Radio.